This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Mark. Today on Sandy Adams Radio, Pastor Sandy will teach through Mark chapter 6.
In ancient Israel, men were referred to by their patriarch's name. Even if the father was deceased, they were the son of their father. But here they call Jesus the son of Mary. In doing so, they were questioning his parentage. Remember, this is Jesus' hometown. And the hometown crowd remembered the scandal surrounding his birth, that Mary had turned up pregnant before her marriage to Joseph. And few people in town believed her explanation of a miracle. By calling Jesus the son of Mary, the Nazarenes were saying, "We don't know who his father was." So they call him the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? Sisters, plural. Now, the Roman Catholics teach that Mary remained a virgin for the rest of her life. They call it her perpetual virginity. I think perpetual fertility is more like it. Because here we learn that after Jesus was born, Mary had a minimum of 6 more kids. 4 boys and at least 2 girls. But here's the point. We're told in verse 3, and they were offended at him. They thought Jesus' claim to be anything more than the neighborhood homeboy was sheer scandalous. They rejected him as the Messiah. See, here's the problem. The men of Nazareth were too proud to acknowledge that one of their own was more than a peer. Oh, we played in the sandbox with this guy. How can he be so special? He's just one of us. See, it's true. Familiarity breeds contempt. The more familiar you are with a person, the more likely he or she is to be taken for granted. Notice verse 4. But Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his own country, among his own relatives, and in his own house." What a disappointment this had to be to Jesus. He came home looking for affirmation. Instead, he ended up with rejection. And maybe you've had a similar experience. Your commitment to Jesus has been frowned on by your homeboys. You hoped they would be accepting. Instead, they've rolled their eyes. They've turned up their nose at you. They've been skeptical, if not outright rejected you. Well, at least you're in good company. That's how they treated Jesus. Don't be surprised if it happens to us. As he said, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country. If that's happened to you, you're going to have to re-win their respect another way. Verse 5 is one of the saddest statements in the Bible. Now, he could do no mighty work there except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. That was a pretty good deal, I would imagine, if you were one of them. But he couldn't do any great miracles there because of their unbelief. Now remember, this was Jesus' own hometown. If he worked a miracle anywhere, I'm sure he wanted it to be here among his own friends and family. But he was limited by what? By their unbelief. Lois Chaney, she writes a probing poem inspired by this episode. Follow along with me. There was a place where the unbelief was so great that Jesus, the Son of God, could not heal and help, and so he left them. Has anyone seen Jesus lately? Has Jesus been seen in your life lately? Friends, he can do amazing works, but the prerequisite is always faith. Verse 6, he marveled because of their unbelief. 2 times in Scripture we're told that Jesus marveled. Here at the unbelief of the Nazarenes and in Luke 7 over the faith of a Roman centurion. You remember the centurion believed that Jesus could heal his servant with just a word. Jesus marveled at a Gentile's faith and at the Jew's unbelief. Question is, does he marvel at our faith or the lack thereof? Then he went about the villages in a circuit, teaching. First circuit preacher. And he called the 12 to himself and began to send them out 2 by 2 and gave them power over unclean spirits. Jesus begins to delegate to his disciples. He can only do so much himself, only go so many places. And so he sends his disciples out two by two, notice. Hey, two by two. It's a good idea. Batman and Robin. Andy and Barney. Mantle and Maris. Starsky and Hutch. God uses dynamic duos. When you serve the Lord, take a pal. One of you can pray while the other one talks. You can watch each other's back. It proves good fruit always comes in pairs. In verse 8, Jesus commanded them to take nothing for their journey except a staff. Now, he's not talking about an assistant pastor here, or the CPA or bodyguard or something. It's amazing, some preacher, I get so disgusted. Some preachers think they need an entourage wherever they go. They need a posse to minister somewhere. The staff Jesus is talking about here is a stick, not some pastoral posse. Also, no bag. Don't take a bag. Literally, a beggar's bag. Don't beg for funds. Hey, God's work done God's way will never lack God's support. Where God guides, he provides. You got to trust him. No bread, no copper in their money belts, but to wear sandals and not to put on two tunics. In other words, God's ministers need to travel light and live by faith. They need to be simple. Don't be burdened down with a lot of baggage in the ministry. Also, he said to them, in whatever place you enter a house, stay there till you depart from that place. I love this paraphrase of these verses. It says, don't think you need a lot of extra equipment for this. You are the equipment. No special appeals for funds. Keep it simple. And no luxury inns. Get a modest place and be content there until you leave. In short, kiss it, man. Keep it simple, saint. Kiss. That's the plan. And whoever will not receive you nor hear you when you depart from there, shake off the dust under your feet as a testimony against them. If somebody rejects you, hey, if somebody at your office rejects you, your neighbor rejects you, hey, forget it, move on. Don't stand around feeling sorry for yourself while other folks need to be saved. Don't get bogged down in bitterness. Wipe the dust off your souls and move on to other souls. God will deal with the resistors. Assuredly, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. So they went out and preached that people should repent. And they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and healed them. His disciples were now empowered by Jesus. Now King Herod heard of Jesus, for his name had become well known. This Herod was Herod Antipas, son of Herod the Great, the one who murdered the children of Bethlehem. He said, John the Baptist is risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him. I'm sure this was his guilty conscience speaking. Antipas was complicit in the Baptist's murder. We're going to read about it in a minute. Others said it is Elijah, and others said it is the prophet, or like one of the prophets. But when Herod heard, he said, no, this is John, whom I beheaded. He has been raised from the dead. Remember, Jesus and John were cousins, and tradition says they had a striking resemblance. Herod here is haunted by John's memory, this man that he's murdered. Now, it's interesting, this Herod, he had wealth, he had power, he had luxury, but he was tormented. He was tortured by a guilty conscience. It's been said, a guilty conscience is the part of you that hurts when everything else feels good. A condemned conscience prohibits you from enjoying life. It's also been said, a bad conscience has a good memory. And this was always on Herod's mind. The next few verses recall his crime. For Herod himself had sent and laid hold of John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. For John had said to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Now, Herod Antipas, this was a seedy, immoral man. On a visit to Rome, he had fallen in love with his half-brother's wife, Herodias. He divorced his own wife, and he stole Herodias from his brother. By the way, she was not only his sister-in-law, she was also his niece. So add this all up, and the king was guilty of divorce, adultery, and incest. Herod had turned Israel's royal family into a soap opera. But John here calls him on the carpet. John was fearless. Intimidated by no one, John took on this ruthless king. He said, "It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife." And he must have said it in a very public fashion. Therefore, Herodias held it against him and wanted to kill him. But she could not, for Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man, and he protected him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. Now, in his own warped way, King Herod respected John the Baptist. Understand, this Herod was a politician. He based his decisions on the latest opinion poll. In contrast, John had integrity. These two men couldn't have been more opposite. And yet, despite Herod's admiration of John, Herodias hated the Baptist with a vengeance. She was a wicked, wily king who didn't like being publicly rebuked. Then an opportune day came when Herod, on his birthday, gave a feast for his nobles, the high officers, and the chief men of Galilee. Did you know there are only two birthdays mentioned in the Bible? Man, you got to be careful about birthdays. Pharaoh's birthday, the baker was hung. Remember back the story of Joseph? Here, John the Baptist loses his head. Biblical birthdays are dangerous, man. I'm just telling you. And I hope you never have a birthday party like Herod's. This was a drunken orgy, man. This was a stag party. Verse 22, when Herodias' daughter herself came in and danced. And understand, this wasn't like my granddaughter coming in and showing me her latest ballet steps. No. This was a strip tease. This was a immoral, seductive dance done before these men. Her name was Salome, by the way. Usually these seductive dances were performed by prostitutes. It was very rare for a princess, for a woman of social standing, to perform such a dance. But here Herodias puts her daughter up to doing this. And her dance pleased Herod and those who sat with him. The king said to the girl, "Ask me whatever you want and I will give it to you." He also swore to her, "Whatever you ask me, I will give it to you up to half of my kingdom." So she went out and said to her mother, "What shall I ask?" And she said, "The head of John the Baptist." Immediately she came in with haste to the king and asked and said, "I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter." And the king was exceedingly sorry. Yet because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he did not want to refuse her. Now realize, Herod had an out. He had an out here. He promised the girl up to half his kingdom. All he had to say was that John was worth more than half his kingdom. But lust and pride warps your values. You throw away what's precious for a few empty sips of what's cheap. It's a terrible trade-off. Well, immediately the king sent an executioner and commanded his head to be brought. And he went and beheaded him in prison, brought his head on a platter, and gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to her mother. How sad. What a way to get ahead. In essence, understand this, in essence, John lost his head so that Herod could save face. This is all about pride. Herod didn't want to break a promise and look bad in the eyes of the nobles. He should have buried his pride. Instead, they buried John. And this is similar to the choices people make every single day. What's more important to you, doing right or looking good? Don't ever sacrifice your integrity for some popularity. We're told when his disciples heard of it, they came and took away his corpse and laid it in a tomb. This flashback is now over. We now know why Herod was afraid of Jesus. Well, Mark returns to the disciples who had gone out two by two. They come back now in verse 30. Then the apostles gathered to Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. And he said to them, "Come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while." For there were many coming and going, and they did not even have time to eat. Now, it's true. If we don't learn to come apart, then we're going to come apart. Life stress and strain pulls at the seams of our lives. Hyper-busyness is the plague of the modern world. It's been said the bow that's always bent ceases to shoot straight. This is why Jesus knew that time away, a break from the action, is essential to maintaining godly priorities. And listen, if this was true for Jesus, the perfect Son of God, how much more true is it for you? This is why he's given us a Sabbath. One day in seven, we can stop and rest and contemplate and reevaluate our lives. We need time away, time to rest, time to unwind and regroup. Verse 32, and so they departed to a deserted place in the boat by themselves. But the multitude saw them departing, and many knew him and ran there on foot from all the cities. They arrived before them and came together to him. The crowd beat him to the spot that they were headed in the boat. And Jesus, when he came out, saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them because they were like sheep not having a shepherd. I can hear the disciples, won't they leave us alone? But Jesus was moved with compassion. He saw people not as a nuisance, not as an obligation, but as lost sheep in desperately in need of a shepherd. And so he began to teach them many things. Now, when the day was now far spent, his disciples came to him and said, this is a deserted place, and already the hour is late. Send them away that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy them some bread, for they have nothing to eat. In the spring in Galilee, the sun sets around 6 o'clock in the evening. Thus, it was about dinner time, and there were a lot of people to feed. Verse 44 tells us 5,000 men. Add the women and children, and there could have easily have been 15,000 people. And there was no Chick-fil-A anywhere in sight. But Jesus answered and said to them, you give them something to eat. You give them something to eat. You know, there are times when Jesus lets us try to do it ourselves, just to remind us how hopeless we are. I picture these men doing the math, you know, scratching their heads, writing on the back of their hand, doing the calculations, drawing the, there's no way. No way. And they said to him, shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give them something to eat? This is a little sarcasm there. They know there's nowhere around to purchase any bread, especially that much. Finally, Jesus does some math of his own. Not new math, but miracle math. He said to them, how many loaves do you have? Go and see. And when they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he commanded them to make them all sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in ranks, in hundreds and in fifties. Notice Jesus tells the disciples to organize the people. It's going to make the distribution easier. Some super spiritual people often think that any effort on our part to organize will quench the work of the Holy Spirit. It sure didn't this day. It helped in the distribution. Here, organization is Jesus' idea. Spirit-led organization and a Spirit-filled miracle often go hand in hand. Verse 41. And when he had taken the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven, blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And the 2 fish he divided among them all. So they all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of fragments and of the fish. Now those who had eaten the loaves were about 5,000 men. This was a miracle of multiplication. The creator of matter rearrange the molecular structure of the fish and the bread. Jesus manipulates the molecules to make enough food for 5,000 plus hungry mouths. And notice the 12 baskets of leftovers. Notice there were 12. One basket of leftovers for each of the disciples. It was as if he was showing them and us that he is more than able to meet our needs in abundance. This story forever teaches us that if we give Jesus all we have, he can turn our meagerness into much. But here's the key. Before Jesus multiplies the fish and chips, notice what he does with them. For this is what he does with us. He took them. Then he blessed them. Then he broke them. and then he gave them. Jesus takes us out of the world. He blesses us with all spiritual blessings. He wants to give us to the hungry folks around us. But before we can be given, we first have to be broken. For if not, people will choke on our pride. We'll cause spiritual indigestion. Hungry people will break their teeth on our hardness and spit us out. This is why we have to be broken. We first have to be humbled. And Jesus has his ways. That obstinate boss, that financial crisis, Jesus can arrange the crushers. Brokenness isn't pleasant, but it is certainly necessary. Verse 45, immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he sent the multitude away. And when he had sent them away, he departed to the mountain to pray. Now when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he was alone on the land. Then he saw them straining at rowing, for the wind was against them. Notice, Jesus was on the mountain, but he sees his men straining in the midst of the storm. And this is where Jesus is today. This is what's happening today. Hebrews tells us that he is seated next to God in the heavenly mountain, on the right hand of God. And what is he doing there? He's interceding for us. He's praying for us. He sees us in our storm, and he will come to us at just the right time. It was about the fourth watch of the night he came to them. Jesus waited until the darkest hour of the night. The fourth watch began at 3 a.m. Jesus came when they were utterly exhausted, after they'd been rowing for 8 hours. And this is what Jesus does in our lives. He comes to us after the storm has beaten out of us all of our self-sufficiency. Jesus waits to appear until we're mentally befuddled and physically depleted. And that's when Jesus came to them, walking on the sea, and would have passed by them. I mean, they weren't expecting him. I mean, his coming to them was a complete surprise. They almost missed him. In one moment, Jesus was nowhere to be found. But the next moment, he was now here. Notice the difference, nowhere and now here. How quickly nowhere can become now here. Remember that in your storm. And when they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were troubled. But immediately he talked with them and said to them, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid." Then he went up into the boat to them, and the wind ceased. And they were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure and marveled. Jesus calmed the storm from inside the boat before he calmed the storm at sea. And this is how he works in our lives. Jesus wants you and I to trust him in the midst of the storm before he gives us victory over the storm. He calms the storm in the boat before he calms the storm on the sea. And notice the reason for this trial. It's the reason for all our trials, quite frankly. Verse 52, for they had not understood about the loaves because their heart was hardened. This episode was a means of softening their hearts. They didn't learn the first time, so Jesus reissued the test. You know, if you don't like the test, you ought to learn a lesson. Or he'll just keep reissuing the test. Now, when they had crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret and anchored there. And when they came out of the boat, immediately the people recognized him, ran through that whole surrounding region, and began to carry about on beds those who were sick to wherever they heard he was. Wherever he entered, into villages, cities, or in the country, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and begged him that they might just touch the hem of his garment. And as many as touched him were made well. Needy people were flocking to Jesus, and we're among them. Why don't you reach out and touch the hem of his garment?
Being on the go is something we're all accustomed to in this culture. The hustle and bustle of life seems to make the days just fly by. For most of us, our smartphones are sort of an extension of our bodies, constantly ringing and dinging, telling us where to be and what the next appointment is. The technology that we enjoy in this day and age is amazing. And while there's certainly no end to the bad things we can find online and through our smartphones, there's also some great kingdom-minded options. We'd like to invite you to download the Sandy Adams mobile app. Our mobile app is available for iPhone, Android, and Windows smartphones. Or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the link from the main menu. When you download the app, you'll be able to listen to the most recent messages taught by Pastor Sandy, browse the series archive, and search the archive alphabetically. Finally, when you download the mobile app, you'll also have the opportunity to join us live for our Sunday morning worship service right from your smartphone. Again, to download the Sandy Adams mobile app, simply enter Sandy Adams in the search options of your smartphone's app store, or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the mobile app option right on the homepage. And please join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Bible right here on Sandy Adams Radio.